To item number nine, this is a briefing. Visual aids.
I've never seen a Pinto shell.
It's an empty one. Abalone status review and listing recommendations.
I'm busy right now.
He woke up for it. So Hank, turn it over to you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, and Mr. Director, Mr. Assistant Director, and members of the public. Thanks for welcoming a shellfish element to today's meeting. I think, as you see, there's some enthusiasm in this group, too. And we're going to talk to you today about the status of Pinto abalone in the state of Washington. I'm Chris Early. I'm Puget Sound Shellfish Policy Coordinator. I provide a range of policy support on shellfish-related items. And I'm joined today by Dr. Hank Carson. Hank leads our subtitle Shellfish Management Group, has a role in managing fisheries for the various and wonderful species you might encounter while diving, including Pinto abalone. So Hank, take it away.
Thanks, Chris. I'm going to talk to you today really in four parts. We'll start with sort of a historical overview. That's the life history of the species and also of the fishery. Move into the what we know about population status currently. The third part is what we're doing about it, the recovery program. And then fourth, a little bit about this status review process we're undertaking now. So one of my favorite animals, the Pinto abalone. This is a picture of a couple of our hatchery-raised animals. You can see the tags right on them there. They're a shallow water marine mollusk, so a snail. They're Washington's only species of abalone. They're restricted to rocky habitats, as you can see. These ones, they particularly like this rock with the pink crustose coralline algae over it there. They feed on algae, both as young animals, on microscopic algae grazed right off the rock, and then later moving into adults right directly on the kelp itself. They range from Sitka, this species ranges from Sitka, Alaska, all the way down to Point Conception, California. And I'll tell you a little bit about their reproductive biology and life history, because it's going to become important later. So here's some abalone in a rocky reef habitat. We made them intentionally hard for you to see, because that's how they are in the wild. There's some little ones right here. Grazing on their diatoms and algae, and they're free spawning individuals, so they're putting eggs and sperm directly into the water, and fertilization is occurring outside the body. After fertilization, they're drifting around in the plankton for about a week, perhaps, as a larval stage, and then settling back down into that rocky habitat, hiding in cracks and crevices and among the algae as juveniles, and then growing up to a reproductive size of about 50 millimeters, maybe the size of a little bit smaller than the one I placed over there, where they'll then emerge and be a little more evident. This diagram, put together by one of our partners, Puget Sound Restoration Fund, kind of shows an important part of this biology in that here we've got abalone on this side of the diagram that are closer together, and so when they're spawning, they're achieving fertilization and we're getting reproduction. But we've also got one that's over here that's spawning alone, and so there's probably no fertilization happening, and there's probably no reproduction coming out from this individual. These animals can move pretty fast for a snail if motivated by, say, a predator, but we don't think they undertake big migrations to go find mates. So this is going to become important later because the density of these adults is really important to how much reproduction you're getting. The range in the state shown here, see some of our, we've got some symbols over some of the most extreme observations. We've got one in the north, in the northern San Juan Islands on Patos Island. The westernmost observation is from the mouth of the strait by Nia Bay, and then a couple here on either side of the entrance to Admiralty Inlet. So not a lot of distribution down into the sound, even historically. The other unknown is the outer coast. We don't have any good survey information from out there. It's possible that it's not very good habitat for abalone. They're shallow water species, as I mentioned, and they're on rocks. There's a lot of wave impact energy out here. And also I've shown in a shaded area here, which shows the current distribution of otter and otter foraging. So otter would feed pretty readily on these abalone. So that might also preclude having populations on the outer coast. So a little bit of the history, more of the fishery. Of course, this species has been valued for centuries by inhabitants of Washington, not just for food, but for their decorative shells. And even in modern times, you've probably seen abalone inlay on guitars or in clothing. Cultural importance, the shells were traded pre-settlement. This department, or what was then the Department of Fisheries, gets involved in 1959 when we authorized the first recreational fishery. So there never has been a commercial fishery in the state. We don't really have a lot of data from that era. The real the first data collection starts in the late 70s. The first time we have a good estimate of harvest is from the mid-80s, and this is, again, a hand harvest by divers recreationally, and that estimates we got about 40,000 individuals taken per year in the San Juan Islands only. It's a pretty significant and popular fishery. Also during the same area were the peak years of our sea cucumber and sea urchin dive fisheries. So that's the same, overlapping the same habitat, you know, over rock or hard substrates in shallower waters. Currently, we have about 25 permits for each, but back then there were over 200 vessels participating. So there was a lot of temptation to take abalone illegally along with that harvest. In 1990, British Columbia closed both their commercial and sport fisheries due to declining stocks. On the basis of some survey data, we decided in the department to put together a more formal monitoring station. So these were 10 sites in the San Juan Islands that were fixed. We could go back to year after year and count the abalone and measure them to see how the stocks were doing in a more directed sense. In 1994, we went back to those same index stations, saw that there was a decline happening. Also, there was some high-profile poaching that was happening that happened at that time, so that supported the closure of our recreational fishery. So we have not had a fishery in the state since 1994. And here's a picture you may have seen. One poacher apparently made enough money off abalone poaching to buy a whole new vessel. Unfortunately for him, he named it the Abalone Maid and spelled it M-A-D-E. So I think that was a tip to our enforcement to look into his activities a little more. And here's a picture. I think this is actually from Canada, but it just shows the scale of the poaching operation. That back of that truck is filled with hundreds and hundreds of pinto abalone. So it's hard to quantify exactly how much poaching happened, but it was clearly a problem. 96 is when Alaska closed their commercial abalone fishery. They still have a small subsistence fishery still. We put abalone here in the state as a candidate species in 98. 99, the Canadians listed their population as threatened. 2004, our federal government followed suit and put them on the list as a species of concern to look at listing. 2009, the Canadians upgraded or downgraded, depending on how you look at it, from threatened to endangered for the British Columbia population. And then our federal government was petitioned in 2013-2014 to list as endangered or threatened. As you probably know, they were not listed, and as you probably know, to list a species federally that's an invertebrate, does not have a backbone, you have to list the entire range, the entire species, or nothing. You can't, like a salmon, you cannot list a distinct population segment. So the federal government declined to list, finding that there were still some pretty healthy populations in Alaska, and also that there was sort of a lack of differentiation with another subspecies, the threaded abalone, which would extend the range all the way down into Mexico. So just to sort of sum up that part, you know, throughout this subspecies range in Alaska, you've had recreational fishing only since 96. Canada has not had fishing since 1990. We have not had fishing since 94. And there hasn't been a lot of of fishing in Oregon and California, although it has been closed since 2004 there too. I'll point out that there are 7 species of abalone in the whole Pacific coast, 2 of which are federally endangered in Southern California. There used to be, you're probably aware, a popular recreational red abalone fishery just in the northern half of California, but just last year closed because of the problems with the warm water anomaly you've heard of called the blob, really wreaked havoc on their ecosystem, even more than in Washington. And they had to close that fishery. So in the lower 48, you can't really fish for any abalone currently. That brings me to the second part of the talk, the population status. And I've got a square around the San Juan Islands because that's most of where our monitoring and restoration has happened to date. We'd really like to continue into the strait in the future. I'll also point out that I haven't put a lot of maps. I'd be happy to share any of the specific locations of our monitoring or restoration sites with the commission, of course, but in anything sort of public, we try to take maps of where all the abalone are out of it for poaching reasons. This is getting into the most depressing part of the talk. This is the average density you can see on the y-axis of abalone on our 10 fixed index sites from the San Juan Islands. And we've got time on the x-axis across the bottom. When those stations were first established in 1992, the density was about 0.16. As I mentioned before, that dropped to the next survey in 1994, and that was part of the reason that the fishery was closed, this obvious decline once this formal monitoring had started. The hope was at that time that the population would rebound once we removed the fishing pressure, but unfortunately, as you can see, it continued to decline even after fishing stopped, all the way down to our most recent survey was in 2017. In this survey, we found 12 abalone total on these sites. Here in 1992, there were 359. Why did this population not recover when we stopped fishing it? I'm going to put up here a dashed line for a fertilization threshold. Now, I've put a question mark because we don't know where this is actually, but this is what I was talking about before with the diagram of those abalone in the reef. They have to be at a certain density to achieve any fertilization. If you're spawning and there's no one else around, there's no fertilization, no reproduction. As I pointed out, we don't know where this line is. I put it there because of some information from an Australian abalone population. It's probably, if anything, a minimum density required for any fertilization. Also supporting that guess is the fact that when we closed the fishery in 1994, we were already below that threshold. Mm-hmm. So probably why we didn't see recovery. You might be wondering if, you know, does it have to be just density? Was there possibly a disease or something changing in the ocean? I've got some more evidence here that points to the fact that it probably was this adult density problem. And that comes from the sizes of the abalone themselves. So even back to the earliest surveys in 1979, we were measuring the shell lengths of the abalone, the maximum length on the ones on your desk. And you can also use that as a proxy for age. They're generally, obviously larger, older individuals. So this blue peak here is from that earliest survey data. You see about an average size of maybe 80 or 90 millimeters. And also importantly, we got a little bump down here for the little juveniles. Of 20 to 30 millimeters in length. Juveniles are really difficult to find, as I mentioned. They're hiding in the cracks and stuff. So this isn't probably what the actual density of juveniles was, but you can see that they were detected and reproduction was definitely happening back then. As we move later in time, this red peak is from the 90s. You see the population is shifting to the right, larger and older, and we're not seeing any young ones. Into the 2000s, same thing. The peak is getting smaller, shifting to the right, and there's nothing on the left side. If we were to put the average size of those 12 abalone we saw in 2017, they'd be here at 127 millimeters and a little bump. So what it shows us is that we have an aging population that's not reproducing. So just to summarize this second part, our earliest density information comes from 79. And if you did a similar thing today, we found that it's about a 96% decline. This agrees with what we have from the index station data I just showed you. From 1992 to 2017, it's a 97% decline in density. Also, as I just showed you, it seems to us that the population is aging, and we have not seen juveniles. in a decade. The last one that a department employee saw on a dive was in 2008. Not saying they're not out there, but we have not been able to find them. As I also said, there's some other possible factors like disease or climate change, but really the simplest explanation is that it's reproductive collapse due to this fishing them down to a low adult density, sort of over the cliff, so they cannot recover on their own. That is the end, fortunately, of the depressing part of the problem. Let's move into some better news and talk about the recovery program, what we've been doing about this decline already. And this was a partnership between the department and most notably the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. The lead from that organization and hatchery manager Josh is here in the audience today. Also with the universities of Washington, Western Washington, Treaty Tribes, Aquaculture, a big partnership, the Marine Resource Councils came together with the idea that these populations were not going to recover on their own without intervention, which we saw in the data. So we started on a hatchery propagation and release program. What we're doing with that is going out, mainly in the San Juan Islands, and collecting singleton individuals. So we don't want to disturb an existing spawning aggregation. So if we're diving and we find an abalone, we're searching all around it to make sure there aren't other ones that could potentially reproduce in the wild. If there are not, that individual's probably not doing us a lot of good reproductively in terms of the population. So we're
just
bringing...
Point of information, Ken Chu used to sit right here.
Yes. He's a legend in the shellfish world. We're taking those singletons back into the hatchery, spawning them, growing these juveniles up to about a size of maybe about 20 millimeters for a couple of years, and then putting them back out into the wild. There's a lot of disease screening that happens with this. We're trying to get as genetically diverse a hatchery population as possible. And just some photos of our outplanting procedure up here in this corner. We've got a map of a plot we've decided in the San Juan Islands. It's marked in the corners, and it's got lots of nice habitat, lots of places to hide, lots of algae to eat. Measuring them, tagging them. You can see some tags on the shells on your desks. Moving them out into the field and going down. Here we see a bull kelp bed, which they favor. In bringing them down in these tubes and releasing them on the bottom. Here they are crawling out of their tube with the ends pulled off. So to sort of summarize what we've been doing in recovery, we're collecting singleton broodstock from the San Juan Islands. We're only outplanting that first generation. We don't want to start hatchery inbreeding. To this point, we've outplanted over 15,000 of these from about 96 different crosses between males and females, and we put them on 12 sites in the San Juan Islands. The survival we've seen on those sites after just the one-year mark after outplanting, so now they're about 3 years old, is 10% from the outplant to the one-year survey, which may not sound that great to you, but it sounds wonderful to me as a marine invertebrate biologist talking about little tiny animals that can be eaten by all sorts of things. I also put observed up there because, as I mentioned, it's really hard to find abalone that are that size. We've done some work with the tagging and mark recapture to figure out what percentage we're seeing on any given survey, and it's as low as 20% and as high as about 40%. So I think you could easily double the numbers I'm showing you here in terms of the number of abalone that are actually on the plot. But I'm trying to tell you just what I've seen with our own eyes is a 10% survival. Same thing, survival a couple years later to that reproductive size averages about 3.5% that we can see. And so most of our sites now have this reproductive density. They're a viable spawning aggregation to help support the population. So we view this sort of pilot scale as a success. However, I said these populations are not going to recover probably without this sort of intervention, and we'd need to scale this up if we were going to achieve a true impact on the population. To that end, we've already started some experiments trying to optimize this whole hatchery and outplanting procedure, experimenting with outplanting younger juveniles, doing a cost-benefit analysis. They might not survive quite as much, but they're a lot cheaper to produce when they're younger. It's kind of a balance there, even working with putting out larval stages. So I'll end my talk here just talking a little bit about the status review process that we're embarking. Last week, hopefully you all received our preliminary status review document and recommendation to list as endangered. Public comment on this process and that document started in October 2018 and will go through March. We've gotten, I think, 28 comments and 3 letters of support so far that have all supported the listing, but there's a lot more time for people to weigh in. We're not just passively looking for comment. We've done a lot of outreach to the tribes, recreational dive communities, different groups, aquarium and science centers. We've done a couple of public meetings already to gauge public support in Anacortes and Port Townsend to try to get people aware of this process and to get their opinion on it. Our schedule with this group, we'd like to, after this public comment process concludes, come back and do the final sort of public hearing here at the April meeting, if that works out. And then we would then present a final status report and recommendation at that time for your consideration. And then one last slide on what would the implications be if you decided to list the Pinto abalone as endangered. We think one of the most important things, it would clearly communicate the status of Pinto abalone to the public, to the legislature, to private donors and funding agencies. I was having a conversation the other day when I was in Port Townsend with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and they have they're partnering with Puget Sound Restoration Fund to raise some abalone, and they've got a cool display there. And she was saying how awkward it is when people ask, well, why are you doing this? Is this an endangered species? And she has to say, well, no, not technically, but didn't try to talk about the status. So I think not a lot of people know what a species of concern is, but I think everybody knows what an endangered species is. Also, we made and hope to make in the future big investments in this Pinto abalone restoration, and we think a listing could protect that investment. Right now, if you took an abalone illegally, it would be fishing in a closed season, but if listed, of course, the infractions would go up, the penalties would go up for enforcement, and also there's just more of a stigma. If there is some low-level take by recreational divers, for instance, I think they may think, well, what's the harm in taking just one? I think the stigma of now you're taking an endangered species is an important one. Done a lot of work before we even decided to pursue listing to talk to communities about what would the regulatory burden be, and this is something I'm still looking for a lot of input on, but for so far I have not heard a lot of people saying that there's a lot of things that would need to happen in terms of our shoreline master programs if abalone were listed. The reason for that is that some counties already have them as a species of concern on their list of sort of things you would need to survey for. So changing that to threatened or endangered would not really affect that. And also is where their habitat are. They're mostly found in these bull kelp beds, which are already protected. Their habitat in the near shore overlaps with orca, salmon, all sorts of other protected habitats. So I'd love to hear more input and feedback on this, but I don't see a big regulatory burden at this time that listing would create. A little quirk that it's important for you to know about is that, and I think this is a holdover from the merger of the Department of Fisheries, was that you can only list a wildlife as threatened or endangered in the state of Washington. And abalone are not wildlife. They are a food fish or shellfish. So we've gone to the Attorney General's office, and I can provide you with a memo if you'd like. They've written an opinion about how we would do this. You could declassify Pinto abalone as a shellfish and then immediately put them on another list if you so desired. And then, of course, our part would be to develop a recovery plan to present to you guys within 1 year after listing, and then there'd be status reviews every 5 years. I think I'll stop there just to acknowledge the many partners that have made this possible, and, of course, the many divers. We do most of this work in the winter. Got a picture here of our boat with snow on the deck. We have a lot of fun, but it's also very cold.
Well, thank you. That's cool. Questions? Yes?
How long does it take an abalone to mature to the size that you distributed to us here, say?
That's probably about a 6 to 8 year old.
Okay. And they're actually growing their shells as they grow.
You can see the, you know, you can imagine the juvenile that's right on sitting on top of that shell.
Yeah. sort of like the rings of the tree, we can see the ridges as they... As
exactly, exactly.
Fascinating. Interesting.
Go ahead, I guess.
So is there any subsistence take of Pinto abalone in Washington?
None reported.
Okay. And then a second sort of technical question. So that the issue with DPS and invertebrates, if the service agreed, or if it was agreed that they were truly subspecies, the two groups, the southern group and ours, could it then be a DPS and it would be reconsidered, or...
I understand that even the subspecies level, I think it's the entire species or nothing.
Okay.
But I was just bringing that up to say that the range would be even larger than we sort of consider it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm aware Bellingham Technical College has the hatchery program, and they're getting into shellfish. Mm. They're partnering with Taylor and other ones, but they're to raise people to do shellfish. So I would, it might be a good, if you're looking for other partners to help do that, that I think that would be a good partnership.
We definitely are. One of the thoughts of a scaling up, you know, if we're going to achieve true recovery, would be to have to scale up hatchery production, right. Certainly. And the new facility in Manchester is really helping with that. I showed you the pictures. Yeah. I guess I should have mentioned that the hatchery started at the Mukilteo facility with Noah, and it's just recently moved to Manchester and expanded. So we have a little more capacity, but I think we need even more still to achieve recovery.
I'll put you in touch with them. Okay. The director and I had a tour of the hatchery two weeks ago. Yeah. And they're really excited, and they have good partners again with like Taylor,
right.
and I forget the other, do you remember? to ranch it up, to go from fish to into the shellfish world.
Right. I believe we've also accepted an invitation to sit on their advisory committee to help shape the program.
I'm sorry, I put you on. What's your name? Yeah, that was that, because I was thinking what we're doing here, and I said, we need to get DFW on that. Yeah, so that's a good link.
And the idea might be to have the Manchester facility be sort of the hub, and then do grow out.
Exactly, right.
Grow it and outreach at you know, Aquaria, or you know, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center is already doing some.
Well, when you mentioned Port Townsend, that's what triggered that thought. And a friend of mine's a native up in Sitka, and they removed a lot of otters in the greater Sitka area, and the population of abalone is. I mean, he goes down at low tide and just. You know, but he sent me some, yeah, so I had to eat them. But no, at the end of the day, this is a great presentation, and there's a great story here. Should I be optimistic?
Yes.
Okay, that's all.
We're going to save them.
Okay, that's cool. That's good.
Good answer. Slide number 11. Is your population graph, and this is kind of a follow-up to Commissioner Thorburn's question about a federal listing. They're from Alaska down to California. You mentioned
Correct.
In California there's been some problems. And so if the federal government has looked at this and said that they do not warrant listing, they have looked at it and said that, this graph that you've got here, which is not that one, it shows a presence of these on the Washington coast and up the straits and around the corner and between California and Alaska. So this is a subset of the habitat in Washington. What do you know about the possibility that that you don't see this pattern elsewhere, since it's apparently not an obvious pattern in Alaska or Oregon or California? And then I'll throw out the other question about your WAC designation as a wildlife.
I'm not sure I understand your first question completely.
Well, the federal government says they're not
in a status that deserves listing as threatened or endangered.
Right. Throughout their range.
Throughout their range. You mentioned in California things are not good. You've got a graph here that is a spot in the San Juan Islands. It's not necessarily data collected throughout the state of Washington, even. So in this question of federal listing versus state listing, how do you feel about the fact that you don't have information from everywhere? And then on the WAC designation from fish to wildlife, which is a separate question, salmon are federally listed. They're a fish. And so they're not state listed?
Yeah, and I think on the second question first, I think you know, part of the reason we didn't pursue this earlier was to see if the federal government was going to list them, and then sometimes you may not need to list them in the state because of the federal protections. So I think that's the difference there. On to the first question, I think there is probably the least amount of information in Oregon and California about pinto abalone. Maybe because there are many other species there, some of which are federally listed in a lot worse shape. Also because they tend to go deeper in the southern part of their range. As you might imagine, they're a northern, cooler water species. So there's less information because they're a deep water species in California as opposed to here where they're in the shallows. But, you know, you read the status review document, and they did a very, very thorough job of going through and they recognize that maybe the best information about population status comes from Washington, and that's the most depressing. However, they have to balance positive news from Alaska, some positive news from British Columbia into their thoughts. And also the problems in California about with the blob of warm water, those happened in 2015. And this status review ended in 2014, so they weren't aware of what was about to happen to their California current ecosystem at that time. I don't know if they would make a different decision today.
Any other question? Thanks. I feel optimistic. So
thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks for serving on that advisory board, too.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Thanks for getting the connection going.
Yeah, just when I was thinking, I'm thinking of Rich too, you know. So.